We have a cabinet member joining us today, Bob Freiling of IVP. And I found out something I didn't know about him this morning, that he grew up in New England, and I asked him what he liked about fall, and he said, oh, the colors of a New England fall and the start of a new academic year. He's going to talk to us today about his new book that he wrote in part while he was on sabbatical. So I guess writing is resting for somebody from IVP. So.
Thank you, Jill, and thanks to all of you for coming this morning. I do bring you greetings from the folks at IVP, and also want to take the opportunity to thank you for your concern and prayers for us. We still are going through difficult times. We're in the middle of an 18-month salary reduction, and our sales so far this fall are quite a bit behind schedule. So we still have a lot to face, but morale is strong, and we're looking forward to joining many of you at Urbana. Well, last spring, Roger Anderson asked if I would come and share with you about the book I was writing. And it was a step of faith on his account because I hadn't finished the book. But then again, Roger isn't here, so maybe you... but he did. But he did apologize that he couldn't be here. Fortunately, I did finish the book, and so I can share a bit with you about it. But probably like any author, it's impossible to share a book that takes 5 years to write in just 15 minutes or so. So what I did is I prepared a copy of the outline of the book, and I'm just going to refer to that, so that may be easier to follow through it. But when we have authors at IVP, we often like to hear the backstory. What was behind the book? What was involved in writing it? And that sort of sets up reading it a lot better. Well, 40 years ago, Barney Ford and I came to orientation for new staff here in Madison, and John Alexander was president, and one of the verses that he taught on was Psalm 78:72. And if you're familiar with that psalm, it's a psalm that just rehearses all the failings of the people of Israel and how they didn't do this and didn't do this and didn't do this. But then it ends up that God raised up David, even though with all his failings. And this verse says, and David shepherded them with integrity of heart, with skillful hands he led them. I remember being intrigued and challenged of what it would be like to have this sense of integrity of heart, the inward journey, and skillful hands, external competence in terms of staff work at that time and what I was thinking about. Well, as my jobs have changed in InterVarsity over the years, I've continued to feel challenged by these two elements of my life on InterVarsity. In terms of the leadership and management side, I've read dozens of books, gone to seminars. At one time, I taught the Essentials of Management from the American Management Association. I really felt steeped in terms of leadership literature, and I was involved in leadership. And there's a lot of stuff that has been very, very helpful to me. Almost any new book on leadership I get and read and find value in. But what I found missing was any sense of the spiritual dynamics involved in leadership. That most of the leadership books are technique-oriented, what you do, how you do it, but they weren't dealing with internal issues. Well, concurrently, I was reading books on spiritual formation, going to retreats, practicing silence and solitude, reading Thomas Merton, and also found that tremendously helpful, of things that really were nurturing to the soul. But I found that those books and those experiences often weren't connected with my job or in terms of leadership. They just seemed to be two different worlds. And I wanted those worlds to be connected for me. And so part of the reason I wrote the book was to try to talk to myself. Most books are autobiographical, whether they say so or not, about what it means to bring these two realms together. Eugene Peterson wrote a very kind foreword for me, and he captured it, as you might suspect, better than I did. He said, the problem is that leaders take counsel from those who get things done, and contemplatives look for direction on how to be quiet. we tend to go after what our strengths are and just continually reinforce that without being able to pull them together. And maybe another way of looking at it, the proverbial man with his head in the freezer and his feet in the oven, but on the average felt just fine. So I've lived a lot of my life with those kinds of realities. But I was encouraged by Kathleen Norris, a very wonderful author who wrote Dakota and Cloister Walk, has just written a book called Acedia. She said this: true mystics are not those who contemplate holiness in isolation, reaching godlike illumination in serene silence, but those who manage to find God in a world filled with noise, the demands of other people, and making a living. And that really resonated with my experience. Not that God doesn't call people to contemplation, to isolation, the life of the monastery, but that what does that look like in terms of the kinds of jobs that we have? We're actually involved with deadlines and with budgets and money and people, all the things that challenge us and how to live. So I thought I needed some type of different mental model or how to bring these two things together. And what developed over the years were two models, one left brain and one right brain. And both of them are captured in the cover design that our wonderful designer at IVP drew, Cindy Keipel. You'll notice that the dominant, I think I have it here. No, I have it. Thank you. Image is added of the peacock, and the little bird on top of the ellipse there is that of a nightingale. And that's the right brain part. I'll get to that in a moment. But the dominant image and the outline of the book deals with this concept of an ellipse. And I don't know if any of you remember geometry, but even if you don't, you're probably familiar with the idea that an ellipse has two focal points, which is very different than a Western type style of thinking. In Western culture, we look for the bottom line. We look for the single thing. What's the most important thing? And oftentimes that's helpful, but life many times is not described by one thing. There's ambiguity, there's complexity, there's differences. And ellipse has two focal points that says that two things are just as important as each other for defining what the ellipse looks like. And to give you an example of that, and this is going to look funny, maybe feel funny, but it's not too bad. Hold up your hand right, sir, an inch or two in front of your nose and close one eye and then close the other eye. See how your hand moves from side to side? It's because you're only using one eye. Well, where are your fingers? Are they here or are they here? When you only use one focal point, you're tended to get a distorted view of what reality is like. But when both eyes are together, in a sense, our eyes do create an ellipse. And when they're in focus, we can see with two different perspectives and the things come together in unity. And so that's the mental model that I was working on, because as I look at theology, was Jesus human or is Jesus divine? What's the bottom line? Well, he's both fully human and fully divine. Which is more important, grace or truth? We're seeing some things in the media of where some people believe that truth or ideology is the most important thing. Who cares about how you talk about the other person? Some other people think that just grace and being nice is important. Who cares about the truth? Jesus is full of grace and truth. Both are important. In an organization, there's always a tension between structure and freedom. My experience has been that we very much like structure for the other person and freedom for ourselves. But how to do that in a big organization is hard to pull together. But both are important, just like the body. If we don't have the skeletal structure, we can't move. But if we don't have the muscles that give us the flexibility, neither can we accomplish anything. In multi-ethnicity, we have the polarities of identity and reconciliation. Is InterVarsity a ministry or a business? In many ways, both. We can't afford to not operate by the business principles of being a legal entity in the United States of America, an incorporation, the human resource policies, but we're more than a business. We're a ministry. We care about something more than just the financial aspects. Both aspects need to be done at the same time. The right-brained image is this: the difference between the peacock and the nightingale. And I discovered this through the recommendation of a book by Jim Houston. He didn't write the book, he recommended the book to me, called Prayers from the Ark, by a French nun who was originally written in French. And what she does is takes the various animals that she hypothesized went into the ark with Noah, and writes down what they would have prayed in accordance with their stereotypical attributes. So you have the lion praying about strength and those kinds of things. Well, the prayer that stood out to me the most was the prayer of the peacock. And let me read this prayer to you. A royal train, Lord, more scintillating in jeweled enamel. Look, now I spread it in a wheel. I derive some satisfaction from my good looks. My feathers are sown with eyes admiring themselves. True, my discordant cry shames me a little, and it's humiliating to make me remember my meager heart. Your world is badly made, if I may say so. The nightingale's voice in me would be more properly attired and soothe my soul. Lord, let a day come, a heavenly day, when my inner and outer selves will be reconciled in perfect harmony. To me, that got at the spiritual issues, underlying technique, underlying what we do or what we don't do. But it's really that struggle that not only people in leadership have, but we all have that, of what it means to have integrity. One of the reasons that people are openly criticized, whether they're Christians or politicians, is any form of hypocrisy, where there seems to be dissonance between what the people are and what they say and what they do. So that was my longing in terms of how does this work in leadership? Because my experience is the more you get involved in leadership, the more public you are in what you do, and the more visible you are in who you are. And so the tension to create harmony is greater and greater, and why so many leaders just isolate themselves because they can't stand the microscope. And the pressure can be extreme. Not for most of us, but when you think in terms of national leaders and why good, honest people sometimes fail very greatly. Well, just to comment on a few of the sections of the book to give you an idea what it's about, there are three sections, beginning with shaping our inner world. And I'll probably make the most comments about this since I don't have time to say anything about all the chapters. The first one dealing with the issue of the soul. And I use the image from Psalm 131 about being weaned, that we are content in God. Of what does it mean to have contentment in the midst of busyness? Eugene Peterson wrote a very provocative article on leadership a number of years ago called The Unbusy Pastor. And in it he said this, "The word busy is the symptom not of commitment, but of betrayal." And then he quoted John Owen, one of the Puritans, who said, "The twin perils of ministry are flurry and worry. Flurry dissipates energy, while hurry constipates it," which is sort of an insightful awareness of what happens. In chapter 2, it was one of the hardest chapters to write because I wanted to deal with the issue of sin. And that is always a downer in how to deal with it. And many people don't. Some of us were at a retreat a month or so ago in Chicago with Richard Rohr, a mystic, and some wonderful stuff, but he didn't once mention sin and the idea that you can grow in a deeper relationship with God without dealing with those. To me, it seems biblically impossible. Not that he may not deal with that in other ways, but it just stood out. And originally, what I wanted to do is deal with the compulsions that people feel and the hidden sins that affect us. And I wanted to use the metaphor of spiritual circumcision because it's actually used quite widely in Scripture and is a very powerful image. But because of unwanted sexual imagery or not wanting to make that the focal point, I changed it to the practice of pruning, which is also a biblical metaphor. But dealing with the issues of pruning about reputation, about self-righteousness, about the passion to maximize life and control others, and soliciting praise. These are all the dynamics I feel personally in the struggle to be a leader. And again, I think it applies to all of us to some degree, but sometimes the roles of leadership exacerbate those tendencies. The third chapter was a challenging chapter, the practice of humble thought. particularly since we're in an academic ministry. And the idea of humble thought almost seems like an oxymoron to many people. In fact, Tom Wright, of recent CT notoriety, tells the story of a scholar who wrote scathing reviews of his colleague's work until he actually went to a professional conference and met some of them. And he really liked them, which gave him a great quandary. So he stopped going to the conferences. Which unfortunately is often true in the academic world, that truth for truth's sake trumps any kind of relational integrity. But I struggled with this myself. I had read an article by Henry Nouwen called Descend with the Mind into the Heart. And a lot of teaching, mystical teaching, has this sense that we have to get out of our minds, let go of our minds, and just deal with the deeper inner recesses of who we are. And in a way, I understood that, but also in a way, it didn't make sense with my understanding of Scripture. For instance, Scripture talks about that the heart is deceitful above all things, not the mind. And then in Romans 12, it talks about that we are to be transformed by the renewing of our minds, which seems to imply that mental renewal is part of the transformation process, if not initiating it. So this has been a tremendous challenge for me in working it out. I won't go through the whole chapter, but a couple of things that were helpful to me was to realize that when Henry Nouwen used that phrase, descend with the mind into the heart, he was quoting from a Russian mystic called Theophan the Recluse, which is an indication that Theophan wasn't spending a lot of time on budgets every day. So I wasn't sure he really understood what I was struggling with. But then I realized that he didn't say descend from the mind to the heart. He says descend with the mind into the heart, that the mind and the heart are to be companions on the journey, and that our minds help us have a reference point in terms of truth and understanding, and our hearts and our souls also give us a reference point in response to the Holy Spirit, in response to the relational signals around us. So that was an aha moment for me in trying to live that out. And I love the statement of the historian Patrick Henry. He quotes his mother-in-law, who one time was praying by her bedside, that instead of the normal prayer of make us ever mindful of the needs of others, prayed, make us ever needful of the minds of others. And I thought that's a helpful reference point for us in an academic ministry. Chapter 4, The Dancing Heart, Practice of Involvement. This is the beginning, the transition of moving from the internal issues to external. And one of my favorite characters in history was a man by the name of Gregory, who lived in the late 6th century. He was a monk, a tremendous scholar, a man of prayer, and he was drafted against his will to become pope. He really didn't want the job, but the forces in the church drafted him into this, and he inherited a horrible situation, far worse than what President Obama inherited last January. Rome was at war, it was full of famine and disease, public works projects, the whole city was crumbling, and he had this responsibility to provide all this organizational leadership so people could survive, plus being the spiritual leader of the church. And he struggled with this and wrote and really worked out what it meant to pray in the midst of busyness rather than apart from busyness. In fact, one of his biographers says he was able to formulate a paradigm of spiritual renewal in the midst of busyness and spiritual leadership amid secular demands. And maybe that's why he was called Gregory the Great. He accomplished a great deal, and whether you're Catholic or not, he's really the patron saint, I think, of a godly administrative leader and what we can learn from him. Part 2, Shaping Our Outer World. This chapter 5 was actually material that I had shared at the fall leadership meetings about 4 years ago, and some of you were here for that and graciously encouraged me to write something about it, and that's what ended up in this whole book. But the two main thoughts there is that one of the challenges, or the two challenges we face in terms of living in a frenzied world, one is the external complexities. Things are just getting faster and more complex. And an example of this is to think of how punctuation has been dropped. We no longer use commas. Well, what's the purpose of a comma? It's to pause. You know, so we don't want to pause. And so we have all these kinds of technological ways of speeding things up. So that's one part. In InterVarsity culture, we have eyes very much bigger than what we can do within our own human limitations. But I don't think it's helpful just to blame external things, because a lot of what drives us are our internal compulsions. And let me quote an African proverb. And so this is not something that comes out of a person who's just overloaded with Facebook and iPhones and stuff like that. This is someone writing from the bush. It says, a gazelle wakes up every morning knowing that it will have to run faster than the fastest lion in order to stay alive. A lion wakes up knowing that it will have to run faster than the slowest gazelle in order to stay alive. Whether you are a gazelle or a lion, you wake up every morning knowing you have to run faster to stay alive. Isn't that sadly descriptive of how we may feel sometimes, that you just have to keep going faster and faster to keep our pace? And the antidote I'm suggesting is prayer, because prayer slows us down as well as connects us with our God and with one another. And one of my favorite stories in prayer comes from someone who shared with me about Pope John the 23rd, who is head of Vatican II. And evidently, every night at the end of these month-long discussions and deliberations that make our strategic planning process look simple, he would go into the chapel and say, Jesus, this is your church. I'm going to bed. And what a wonderful spirit. And I've actually used that many times, you know, that just staying up longer won't necessarily fix things anymore. Chapter 6, A Lonely World, Promise of Belonging. And belonging is a wide concept. But let me just quote from Garrison Keillor, because I enjoy his wisdom and insights so much. And he talks about his young adolescent experience when he says, truth, such as in the doctrine of separation from the world, was appealing to those of us with no social skills. If people didn't like us, it was proof of our righteousness. And sometimes we can have that thing that if we are separate ourselves from everything, that somehow that makes us righteous. And yet, part of what the Lord prays in John 17 is how we are to be part of the world. That so it's not an isolation, but it's an involvement, a belonging to one another, belonging to God, and belonging in the world. Chapter 7 is very much an InterVarsity chapter, the practice of shalom. I spent a lot of time talking about gender issues, using the example of the daughters of Zelophehad in Numbers and multi-ethnicity, as well as academic disciplines. And then the last section, shaping our leadership. This is where I try to put things together, using the image in chapter 8, more than a grasshopper from the spies going into Canaan in the book of Numbers, and how these top flight leaders, these blue ribbon panel of soldiers and leaders of their tribes went, and when they saw the giants in the land, they said, we seem like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we look the same to them. And sort of this self-perception of who we are in leadership. And this gets at some of the deeper issues that I have struggled with, and I think most leaders do. When we look at the giants of failure, the giants of self-pity, ego, and jealousy, and the kinds of things that affect our identity in front of others and in our own self-awareness. But like Caleb, our call is to wholeheartedly follow the Lord in who we are called to be. I shared at the board meeting a couple of weeks ago about a rabbi, Azusa, who is an old man, said, in the coming world they will not ask of me, why were you not Moses? They will ask of me, why were you not Azusa? Why were you not who I created you to be and to live within that context of your limitations and gifts and calling? Chapter 9, sort of sticking with this theme of nature and of God's created being, I have found one of the most helpful descriptions for me as I've been an IVP to think of my job as an organizational ecologist, of how to keep the various ecosystems in harmony and to root out toxic trends or tendencies in how we function. So I spend more time about that and how we add nutrients and stuff like that. And in chapter 10, as a grateful creature, building upon Max Dupree's famous dictum about leadership, that leadership is defining reality and saying thank you. And I think that's one of the best things we can do for any relationship we have, whether it be marriage, whether it be roommates, whether it be people in our department, of how we can be clear, define reality, this is the way it is, don't try to pretend it isn't, but say thank you. That combination of gratitude and clarity. And then the quote that I end up the book with, the epilogue from Richard Mao, somebody I greatly respected. He says, if I had to choose one word that captures the essence of Christian character, it would be integrity. To have integrity is to be whole in the sense that all of your parts, all of the elements that make you up, are properly in place and working together in a harmonious fashion. As I wrote this book, I realized it's not going to be a Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. It's not a program, you do this, this, and this, and everything will be fine. Nor is it a seven-storied mountain of Thomas Merton where you just feel lifted up into the realms of spirituality. Rather, it's an attempt to identify the issues that we experience in our normal organizational life and give permission to talk about it and hopefully encourage people to live those things out in how we function together. Because my prayer and the prayer for those who read it is the prayer of the peacock. Lord, let a day come, a heavenly day, when my inner and outer selves will be reconciled in perfect harmony. Thank you.